Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We don't always love rain. But when we hear the old saying, right as rain, we get it. Rain is fundamental to the life we know on Earth. It's in our poetry and song, our emotions and deep memory, and it's in the middle of our struggle right now with climate change. But there's a lot you probably don't know about it. For starters, the shape of a raindrop is just the opposite of how you likely picture it. This hour on Point, we're going deep on rain. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you love rain? Run from it? Thirst for it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Miami, Florida, is Cynthia Barnett, longtime environmental journalist covering all kinds of water issues. Her new book is Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. For an excerpt, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Cynthia Barnett, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Happy Earth Day, Cynthia.
Oh, happy Earth Day to you, too.
I guess it matters that that's where we are. You remind us that we were not the only planet with water once upon a time. Venus, Mars had plenty, maybe oceans. We're the one that still has it. We're the one that's blue. And when you get closer, green, and rain is right at the heart of that.
That's right. Astrobiologists describe us as being in the Goldilocks spot. These planets were all made of the same batch of flying fireballs, but it was Earth that, what was exceptional about us was not that we had water to begin with, it's that we kept it and that we have this fabulous atmospheric cycle that rains down on us all over the world. So that's what's exceptional. It wasn't the water itself. It was the fact that we kept it and it rained.
And an atmosphere that moves it around in just the way rain does with all its unpredictability, with all of its resonance for the human psyche, and sometimes just with a whole lot of water. There's so much in literature, in poetry, in music, and in science. We'll look at all of that with you in this hour, Cynthia, but just want to be reminded of how much of this is out. Here's Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump describing the wet weather he encountered during the rain during the war in Vietnam.
One day, it started raining, and it didn't quit for 4 months. We've been through every kind of rain there is. A little bit of stinging rain, and big old fat rain. Rain that flew in sideways, and sometimes rain even seemed to come straight up from underneath. Shoot, it even rained at night.
Big old fat rain in Forrest Gump with Tom Hanks there. Cynthia Barnett, I know you've written a lot about water. Water is an enormous issue. Sometimes we have too much of it. We're flooded out. Sometimes we don't have enough. Talk to California right now. But what's got you going over the whole landscape of science to literature to poetry and music with rain?
What got me to rain? Well, I think the first part of the answer is that I love rain. I'm a native Floridian. And we have beautiful rains here, but, a lot of sun, too. It's not like Seattle, where it's sort of gloomy with a little bit of rain. Here we get a terrific amount of rain, and it doesn't last long, and it's really beautiful and dramatic. So that's part of it. But really, the seed of the idea came from readers of my two previous books, which were both about water. And I found, as I went around the country talking to people about water and about climate change, even people who refuse to talk about climate change or who don't want to talk about it, they would still love to talk about the weather. They love to talk about rain. They do want to talk about the epic drought and the extreme storms and the, frequency of rainfall and the more heavy downpours that we're seeing. So I really came to see weather and especially rain as a way that, helps draw a larger audience to climate change. But that's also why I wanted to have some fun with it and get into the strange history of the Macintosh raincoat and the music and poetry of rain and the other things that you mentioned.
You've got President Obama in the Everglades today on Earth Day, thinking about the natural environment. You're right there in Miami, where there's plenty of rain, or should be. Walt Whitman, of course, and you quote him here, writes, "I am the poem of Earth," said the voice of the rain. It's been absolutely irresistible to poets just about forever, Cynthia.
Absolutely. Rain, I found rain to be a terrific inspiration for literature, poetry, music. What I didn't expect is that it wasn't always a positive inspiration. So some artists really were depressed by rain and felt down about rain, and yet that inspired some of their best work because, you know, it was an intensity of mood. It may not be the inspiration that I get from rain, but, you know, you can be inspired by rain in a positive way or in a negative way. And Emily Dickinson was one who really didn't like rain. She didn't like bad weather. She wrote a lot of very gloomy letters describing rain, but people who have analyzed her poetry by season can actually show that even those seasons that she felt unhappiest in bad weather, those tended to be the seasons when she produced some of her poetry that was later best known. So that was sort of one, you know, really interesting little piece about rain and creativity that I learned.
You remind us that some of her readers see seasonal affective disorder there, that she was much more productive when it was sunny, but she wrote plenty about the storms. She didn't like them. The storm, Emily Dickinson, there came a wind like a bugle. It quivered through the grass, and a green chill upon the heat so ominous did pass. We barred the windows and the doors as from an emerald ghost, the doom's electric moccasin that very instant passed. Electric moccasins and
oh, the
doom.
Doom's electric moccasin. Really, you really perfectly pointed out that gloom that she felt for bad weather. So you're right. Even though she produced more poetry in sunny times, the researchers who have done this work, which is just fascinating, say that in the gloomy times was when she produced the poetry that later, you know, ended up winning awards or ended up in being collected in anthologies and so on. So that was how they decided to look at the influence on weather on her work.
Here's William Carlos Williams reading from his poem, The Red Wheelbarrow.
So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
Can we still think in simply poetic terms about, I guess we never did. I mean, you write a lot here. There was always poetry, but you write a lot about how desperately people needed it, wanted it, would set off cannons to try and draw it around the Civil War times. It's always this
right.
combination of poetics and emotion, but also straight up need.
Right, absolutely. So ever since, you know, the earliest humans, rain was shaping us. But also, we had this sort of yearning to try to stop the rain or bring more of it. And so, from the earliest times, we find rain gods, for example, a deity of storms and rain was one of the very first rain gods. That was Isker, the Sumerians called him, or Adad, the Akkadians called him. And we always. We've always had this love-hate relationship with rain. I call it a Janus. Rain can be a Janus in our lives. Even though I called rain a love story for me, I've definitely learned that it's not a love story for everyone.
I mean, the theme that I pull up out of all this, and there's much more we'll look at, but we need rain, although, on the other hand, it can overwhelm us. And again mm-hmm. and again, it reminds us of what is beyond human control. This theme of control, it sort of drives us crazy that we can't just mm-hmm. have it on and off when we want it, like a shower.
Mm-hmm. And we've certainly tried, exactly. So that's really the theme of this book. You know, rain is sort of a microcosm for nature, right? We really yearn to control it. You know, first it was rain gods. We've always prayed for rain. And then along the way, it becomes a little more sophisticated. And as you say, we try to bomb the skies to bring rain. We eventually try to seed clouds, and along and along and along, we're sort of trying to defy the atmosphere, right? And that's the bigger picture of climate change too. We've built in those parts of the country where floods are regular. You know, I'm in Miami where hurricanes are regular occurrences.
But
We build there anyway. We're watching Los Angeles and California in the West in an epic drought. We wanted to build there too. So this is the theme of trying to control, and yet in the end we're really never able to. That's always been the lesson.
As softly as we like to imagine it coming down, it's still the master. It's still the boss, rain.
Yeah, that's interesting that you use the word soft, because a soft rain, and sometimes the Irish will call a light rain a soft day. But when you look at the climate change data on rainfall, the real trend is that it's coming down in heavier downpours. So especially in your part of the mm-hmm. country, there are many more heavy downpours than we have ever seen in the 50 years before. But all over the country, even in the arid West, when it does rain, it's raining harder. So I hope we don't lose those soft rains, those soft days.
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Conrad Aiken writes of the syllables of water. Cynthia Barnett, in her book Rain, A Natural and Cultural History, reminds us right there that those syllables may be getting a little more pronounced, a little heavier, heavy downpours that may be coming with climate change and the warming that's gone with it. Little Ladysmith Black Mambazo with Rain, Rain, beautiful rain behind us right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When the sun goes down, the birds on the trees are singing sweet for the night. When the sun says goodnight to the mountain, I am dreaming of the sun, say goodnight.
Rain,
rain, rain, rain, rain, beautiful rain. Rain, 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 beautiful rain. Oh, come,
never come.
Oh, come to me, beautiful rain.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about rain. Rain in poetry, rain in song, rain in puddles in our lives, and what happens when the rain doesn't come or comes too fiercely. Cynthia Barnett's new book is Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. She's an environmental journalist, covers all kinds of water issues, author of Mirage, Florida, and The Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S., of Blue Revolution, Unmasking America's Water Crisis, and now rain, straight up rain. You can join us this hour. Do you love rain, the sound of it, the smell of it? Do you wish you could turn it on and off, like the shower? Does rain remind you that we are not in control? Is it dry where you are? Have you been praying for rain? Cynthia Barnett joins us from Miami. Cynthia, we asked our listeners about their favorite cultural memory of rain. Abukar says the Shawshank Redemption, where Andy's escaping, crawling through the sewer and coming out clean on the other side. Mickey's thinking of Gone with the Wind, I'll Never Be Hungry Again, and the rain coming down. Everybody's got their favorite, Hard Rain Gonna Fall, and Stevie Ray Vaughan, Texas Flood, and right on down. What about yours, Cynthia?
I have to agree with the Shawshank Redemption scene. That is one of my top rain scenes for sure.
The and redemptive power.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was Tim Robbins. You know, I can see Tim Robbins lifting his hands to the sky when he comes out of that horrible foul pipe that he crawled through to escape. And that was just a terrific scene. And I agree with the Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, too, on the rain songs. That's a beautiful song. I think my favorite rain song It's funny because, as I told you, rain for me is a love story, but my favorite rain song is Ann Peebles' I Can't Stand the Rain.
Yeah, that got a lot of play back in the day.
Right.
You remind us of Kurt Cobain, grew up in one of the very rainiest communities in North America.
Yeah, so Kurt Cobain grew up in Aberdeen, Washington, and I looked at the rise of grunge in Seattle, and also the pop music that came out of Manchester, England. So Morrissey and the Smiths, and there was this great irony that the grunge of America and the birth-filled angst, like independent rock of the UK, both came from the cities of rain of those nations. So Manchester in the United Kingdom and Seattle in the United States. And I went to Kurt Cobain's hometown for the book, The Logging Burg of Aberdeen, Washington. And it is a gloomy place, but what's interesting to me about that is that, you know, it's not rain itself that makes the world gloomy. Rain, as I wrote, gives us the very most brilliant colors and on the earth. It even makes the bluest blues in the sky because rain scrubs pollution from the sky. You know, rain gives us our spring flowers and the bright rainforests and so on. The thing about places like Aberdeen is as gloomy as it is because of its industrial heritage. So it's sort of a fallen down logging town at this time. And so when you go, it's not just the gray in the sky, but it's the gray in the shipyards and in the factories that have shut down. And so Manchester was that way, too, in the 1960s. But now that city is really changing and coming back and very dynamic. And you can see that it's not the rain itself that makes a place gloomy. The rain is reflecting the character of the place.
Some see the gloom. Some see the glory. Kurt Cobain, with his Aberdeen's Young Street Bridge there, which he used to say he slept under as a teenager, and wrote Something in the Way off his 1991 album Nevermind, with Underneath the Bridge, the tarp has sprung a leak. You'll hear it.
Underneath the bridge, tarp has sprung a leak.
Kurt Cobain. John's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air with Cynthia Barnett.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you. I come from the land of rain. That is Ireland.
Yes.
Please, Tom, would you remind the audience, when you meet an Irish person, do not say, does it always rain in Ireland?
Okay.
It's annoying.
Okay.
My point is, I heard Cynthia Barnett, is that your name? I just tuned in 10
yes.
minutes ago.
Yes.
And I heard you saying that Ishkar was the god of rain in the Middle East. Is that correct?
He was the god of rain for the Sumerians, and you can see his little statue in the Louvre. He looks quite fearless there behind the glass, but they saw him as a fierce warrior riding on the back of a bull with lightning bolts in his hands.
What do you say, John? Does it fit your Irish image of what a rain god ought to be?
Yes, you know, the Irish word for rain, for water, is Ishka. Can you believe that?
Mm-hmm.
The connection is right there. Also, it's the word for whiskey, of course, Ishka Baha, the
yes.
water of life.
Wonderful, wonderful point.
John,
thanks for that, because I knew we have a genetic link with the people from the Middle East, but I never
yes.
knew that, so thanks for that point.
It's a pretty fundamental word, a little ancient Sumerian showing right up there.
Isn't
in
that
the word
wonderful?
For rain, not to mention whiskey. John, thank you so much for that. David in Virgins, Vermont. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Another great show. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hey, I just wanted to share a little factoid. I can't confirm 100% that this is true. I'm in Vermont now. I did used to live in New Mexico. And down there, we would get the monsoons every afternoon, in the summertime at least. And I heard that the natives down there, maybe the Pueblos, used to refer to the brief and kind of violent and hard-hitting rains that didn't produce much as the male rains, and the long, overcast, quenching rains were the female rains.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that was a very beautiful insight.
I can confirm that. Thank you for making that point. I can confirm that in Native American tradition, but also in Judaism, there are some traditions of rain, hard rain being male, and female, soft rain being female. So I've boiled that down a little too much, but that is a fascinating thing to look at, the way Native Americans viewed rain as male or female, and to see how some religions view the rain as male and the earth as female. And so we would quickly get into topics we probably shouldn't get into on the show if I keep going on about
sexual metaphor in rain.
Right, sexual metaphor. But it's all there in my chapter on praying for rain, the chapter on rain and religion. I can read you a little bit.
We're all ears now.
Okay. Many religions and cultures came to view the rain itself as male, though Native Americans consider driving rain male and soft rain female, both equally vital to sate life and landscape. When the Hebrew God was creating earth, he divided the waters and the heavens above from those on land below. Jewish tradition identifies the upper waters, the rainfall, as male, and the lower lakes, rivers, and springs as female, citing the line in Isaiah, "Let the earth open to receive that it may bear the fruit of salvation." And finally, in Sanskrit, the word for rain, varsha, is derived from the older vrish, which means not only to reign, but also to have manly power and generative vigor. And Hindus, of course, consider rivers female and sometimes even describe those swollen with the monsoon rains as pregnant.
I mean, you can't talk about water or rain without getting to life, reproduction, the whole right. cycle. It's
right.
all right there.
Right.
This hard versus soft rain. I mean, we all know the difference very well, but you remind us in your more environmental scientific side that we may actually be changing the balance of those, that these super heavy downpours are widely seen in the scientific community as related now to climate change.
Yes, in fact, all of the early tremors that we already see related to climate change are really related to water. More extreme rainfall being just one of those, but I'm looking at a map that shows percent increase in heavy precipitation over the past 50 years. And if you look at the northeastern United States, there are 74% increase in heavy precipitation events over the past 50 years. That's the highest in the nation. That's huge. Here where I am in the southeastern United States, it's about 30%. And as I said, even if in the western United States, they too, it's not raining now. Actually, it is raining a little bit now, and the rain it flows off into the ocean, which we could talk about later if you'd like to. But even in the West, when it rains, it is, they're seeing some more extreme rains, more flooding. You remember the Boulder floods from a couple of years ago. Those sorts of events may be related to climate change.
Some of the male-female interplay here, very, very real around rain. You remind us, of course, Chopin's got his famous prelude, the raindrop prelude, which much loved. Tell us the story of how that was written. He was in Mallorca, and his mistress was George Sand or Amandine Dupin, the French novelist, and she came to him in the rain at night. There's a monastery, and he's weeping and playing, hallucinating.
Yeah, so she came upon him in a terrifically heavy rainstorm, and he was composing, and he was sobbing, and it was as if you know, it was as if this terrific rain had actually infiltrated his psyche. But as you say, he wrote what is perhaps the best known piece of rain music that we have now.
Let's hear a little bit from Chopin's Raindrop Prelude. Flat that just comes again and again and again. They're like raindrops. 1838, 39, that winter in the Mediterranean, Mallorca, mm-hmm. With his lover.
And I can read you what George Sand said later.
Yes, please.
His composition that evening was full of raindrops that resounded on the roof tiles, but were translated in his imagination and is in his chant into tears falling on his heart from the sky.
Good to take a novelist for a lover. There, it's immortalized very nicely. Vicky in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. Vicky, you're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if Miss Burnett could address a question I had. About 40 years ago, I had heard about a tribe in the South Pacific area that view water as God, you know, instead of a deity, water is actually God. And I've kind of adopted that principle. Is there any way of knowing what that group of people were?
I don't know the group, but I'll make a comment about water as holy, because I'm very interested in this. If you think about our religions and how much we revere certain waters, for example. The Jordan River is greatly revered, and yet it is one of the most abused rivers in the world. I think it runs at 10% of its original flow. You know, when you read about the Jordan in the Bible, it's got a terrific, terrifically strong flow. And today, if you look at pictures of it today, it's a trickle and
the old
very
River
polluted.
Jordan is deep and wide, maybe not so true anymore.
Right. And the researcher who knows a lot about this is a terrific professor named Christiana Papard, and she's looked at the River Jordan and the Ganges. Here's another river that is among the holiest of all, is the holiest of all to Hindus, and yet it's the most polluted river in the entire world. So I can't answer the caller's question about that specific tribe, but I would say that many, many religions view water or rivers as holy, but there's this strange disconnect. Like, how can we revere water and yet allow the pollution and over-tapping of water that happens, you know, both here in this country and all over the world? It's a disconnect. And I think if we can make that connection again, so I actually write a lot about rain and faith and whether faith communities could help us get to a water ethic or help us, you know, deal with the intractable conversation of climate change. Like, maybe some of these conversations should take place in churches instead of in, you know, political boardrooms, and maybe we would all be better off. But I think it's a very good point that many, you know, people do worship water in different ways.
Humans always, for better or worse, able to approach things in two things at once, to venerate and desecrate.
Yes,
at the same time.
Sometimes at the exact same time. Yes.
Cynthia Barnett's new book is Rain, Natural and Cultural History. We're going to come back and think a little bit about California, where there's not enough rain lately. In fact, a big drought in cities, as we're increasingly being reminded, built on desert land. Cynthia Barnett joins us from Miami. Rain, A Natural and Cultural History is her book. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. A little Jimi Hendrix, Rainy Day Dream Away to take us out here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Rainy day, dream away. Let the sun take a holiday. Flowers bathe and see the children play. Lay back and groove on a rainy day.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about rain. Rain in poetry, rain in song, rain in puddles, in our lives, and what happens when the rain doesn't come or comes down more heavily than we can manage. Cynthia Barnett writes about water and rain as an environmental journalist. This time out, she's gone with everything from literature and film and cultural history to, yes, very much the science and climate change implications of and for rain. Her new book is Rain in Natural and Cultural History. Here's Leonard Nimoy, the late great, reading from Ray Bradbury's short story, There Will Come Soft Rains, from the Martian Chronicles. Story set in California after nuclear wars wiped out the population, sent others to live on Mars. But it still rains here on Earth.
It was raining outside. The weather box on the front door sang quietly. Rain, rain, go away. Rubbers, raincoats for today. And the rain tapped on the empty house, echoing.
Great to hear that voice of Leonard Nimoy again. Cynthia, there in Miami, lots of response for you here. People all over. Num writes, rain makes me happy. Whenever it rains, my mother calls me up to ask, are you happy now?
I love that.
Kara says, rain songs are a staple of Indian popular film. There are many, many wonderful rain songs celebrating nature and sensuality. You had some allusion to that. And here, when people listen to this show all over the world, Steve is listening live in Norway, and he writes to us. He says, big storm rolling across the fjord right now in middle Norway, having a cup of tea. And we're right there. We're right there with him.
Beautiful. I love the point about the Indian rain. And I traveled to India for this book for a really specific reason.
The rainiest place in the world you went
to. There, yes, that was one reason. There was the rainiest place on Earth, but there was also a historic fragrance-making village in northern India where villagers still have done for a long time and still capture the scent of rain from the earth and distill it into a heavenly perfume.
How do they do that? How on earth do you capture
that? Well, the monsoon rains and people that have a chapter on the scent of rain, and the scent of rain really, your memory of the scent of rain comes into this. So it's partly dependent on where you are in the world and your memory of rain. But people who grow up in India seem to have this particularly strong memory and feeling about the scent of rain. And part of that has to do with the fact that it's so dry before the monsoons come. And then the technical name for the scent of rain is called petrichor. This is an oil, a substance that builds up in the earth. And then when those great monsoons come, they release this scent. And so the people in the village who do this, the basic idea is that they dig up bits of soil from the earth and they distill it in sandalwood oil, just like they would roses or other types of flowers, and they create a perfume. It's called Midi Attar, and it smells absolutely wonderful.
I'm crazy for that smell right after the rain, in the summer especially. So fantastic. The raindrop itself, you tell us, we have the wrong idea about the shape of it. Enlighten us, finally, Cynthia.
Oh, right, right. So, right, we seem to have a lot of misconceptions about the rain. So that was the first one. We have this vision that a raindrop is like a drop hanging down from a faucet with a pointy top and a fat bottom. But that image is really upside down. In reality, raindrops fall in the shape of tiny parachutes or hamburger buns. Their tops are rounded by the air pressure.
You are rocking my world. You're rocking my world now. What? What? Upside down parachutes, hamburger buns? Oh, we thought we knew. Carla in Petersburg, Illinois. Thank you for calling, Carla. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just called to say I remember walking home in the rain the day that President Kennedy was assassinated. I was in seventh grade, and I remember walking home and crying in the rain.
Yeah. Rain and
memory. how do you feel about rain now? Has it had an impact for the rest of your life?
No. I mean, no. Sometimes it's wonderful. I remember sitting in our garage on a settee when I was a child, and it would be thundering, and my mother would say, "Well, thunder was just St. Peter rearranging the furniture."
I love that. Memory and rain, it's so powerful. I remember our folks used to, with a warm summer rain without thunder, they would strip us off and send us out to race around the yard. Whoa.
My kids just did that on Sunday. It was warm, and they were so happy to see that shower. They very spontaneously ran out in the backyard and ran around in the rain. It was terrific.
Ilan is calling from Boca Raton, Florida, not so far from you, Cynthia. Ilan, you're on the air. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My wife from Chicago and I lived in Zimbabwe for 20 years, and there are two seasons, a rainy and a dry season. And when the rains come, the savanna grasses turn green almost overnight. Insects abound, the animals retreat into the forests, their six-month stress to find water is over, and we delighted in the rain. We water to water the crops and the flowers, etc., and we understand drought. When we would collect rainwater in buckets to either flush toilets or water the flowers or even wash the car, rain to us was and is life. And your comment about the smell of the rain, we've often said if we could bottle that smell, we'd sell it as a perfume and turn ourselves into millionaires.
Or Indian villagers. Ilan, thank you so much for calling. That's great. And capturing it everywhere. You remind us, Cynthia, that we may have to change our relationship with rain, that we may not be able to be so cavalier as we've often been about it. We built in floodplains and we get flooded out, and maybe those floods grow stronger. California right now. I mean, here's a little sound from the movie Chinatown. Of course, a big part of the plot. Wonderful film. If you haven't seen it, it's just great. It's about bringing water to Los Angeles, a city that doesn't get much rain, definitely not getting rain at the time of the film. And in the opening scene of the movie, the mayor is making the case to build an aqueduct to carry water to farmlands to Los Angeles.
Now remember, we live next door to the ocean, but we also live on the edge of a desert. Los Angeles is a desert community. Beneath this building, beneath our streets, is a desert. And without water, the dust will rise up and cover us as though we never existed.
Then it was a movie. Now it threatens to be reality. Governor Jerry Brown having everybody cut back on water use in California in the middle of a big drought. Practical implications, Cynthia.
So the interesting thing about Los Angeles is that it does rain in Los Angeles even now. Just the other day, there was a 0.37 inches fell, and I actually wrote a story about that, about I followed the rain. Where does that go? So when a little bit of rain falls on Los Angeles, because the city was actually built to withstand floods, you know, they're also subject to terrible flooding.
Yeah.
The city leaders built enormous dams, and they straightened the LA River and really enormous concrete storm drains, everything designed to get rid of water, get rid of water, get rid of water, get rid of rain. And so that now when there is a drought of this proportion, all of that manna falling from heaven is swept up into concrete storm drains and swept out to the Pacific Ocean. So Los Angeles is working now to change that. They're restoring they're redoing the stormwater system so that they can catch more rain. And so if they can catch more, it will trickle back down to the aquifer.
Instead of going right into the Pacific and
yes,
lost
exactly.
In the salt.
And right. And the other thing that happens, rain is not as clean as we think it is either. So when all that storm water flows to the Pacific Ocean, it really pollutes the seas. And so if we can, you know, if rain can do what it's supposed to do, which is to, you know, trickle back down into the ground and make its way back to the aquifer, it gets cleaned on that journey as well. So it is really important to restore that relationship that we have with rain. And we're doing it. There's a wonderful field of green building that is making some of this stuff happen all over the country.
Help us here. Rain not as clean as we think, but surely when it comes down it is. For all those kids standing out in the summer rain with their mouths wide open, one hopes it comes down clean. You're saying after it sort of passes through all the muck it hits on the ground.
Well, I will say that writing this book has helped me see that everything we put out into the world really does come back to us. I mean, that is the lesson of pollution. Whatever we're putting in, whatever emissions we're burping out into the atmosphere, they do come back down to us in the rain. So, you know, even the nitrates, even the things you worry about in your river does come back in the rain cycle because this is all connected. So, and that's true for rain, but yes, the rain gets really dirty when it hits the, you know, just think about the miles and miles of asphalt rooftops all over the nation and all the bad stuff that collects on there. So the rain hits that, it flows down car parking lots, it flows down highways covered with oil and all kinds of detritus. And so that's where rain becomes storm water. And it makes its way, you know, when it makes its way out to the ocean, it can be very, very polluting. And that's true of lakes and rivers and the sea.
Can sure taste good, though, when it comes down right. I grew up with well water, but my grandparents had no well. They had a cistern. And
the
collected rainwater, and that was just the softest, sweetest water to have. Brian in Montreal, Canada. Brian, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, both of you. I wanted to talk from a technical kind of point of view about how rain has struck me all my life. I remember the American pop culture that impressed me most was Lil Abner, which got front page coverage in the Weekend Funnies.
The comic strip.
And my favorite character of all in Lil Abner was Job Footslook. He was just a minor character, but he was always scowling. He was always suffering terrible bad luck, and he always had a black rain cloud pouring down,
spattering down on him. Yeah.
And that sort of made me conscious, and even in my working life, which has been building things all around North America, the most destructive force that engineers and builders and architects have to watch out for is the rain we generate with our own household humidity. Because rain, it starts as vapor, and it comes at a place where warm and moist meets cold and dry, and that happens in all of your houses here in the northern half of this continent anyway. And it's something every good builder has to really keep in mind.
So that you don't get mold or buildup, I guess you're saying.
Rot. Things slowly but steadily rust and rot. We lose bricks off of high rises here in our coastal climate in North here, Canada, because the rust rusts away the whole things that hold the bricks on the wall. And they either come down one at a time, or in a bad situation, they come down entire walls at a time.
Well, that's the price we pay, though, right? I mean, we could build a nice building on Mars. It wouldn't have any rain on it, but then the rest of the deal isn't so attractive either.
But there's two really wonderful places I wanted to alert your listeners to.
Yes.
My friends who've been hang gliding pilots, you know, those paper darts grown up into full size that humans hang from, they get to fly up to the place where the dry, clear air meets the moist, condensing clouds. And they actually get to know that really intimately the way no humans have ever done before.
Wow. Yeah.
And I wanted also to flag for you that America has the most amazing cloud forest at sea level. The Alaska Panhandle just blew me away when I spent a March there. You just get out 2 feet from the nearest town, and you are living in a cloud forest with the ocean at your side, and everything is at 100% humidity. There are more colors of green in that humid, rainy environment than anywhere else I've been on Earth.
Brian, you're a rain poet, and we're happy to have you join us.
He really is, and proving the point that rain gives the world its color. It really does. And to his point on architecture, I quote the 15th century Italian architect, philosopher, poet Leon Battista Alberti. He cast rain as the great enemy of any building, always prepared to wreak mischief. Rain never fails to exploit even the least opening to do some harm.
Yes, and in it will seep. Michael in Buffalo. Michael, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Called many times to your wonderful show. I'm so honored to finally get on.
Great.
The rain, to me, is so exciting. One of the strangest rains I experienced was in Dania, Florida, just off Fort Lauderdale. It was like a late afternoon in November, December, and everything looked like it was going to be beautiful, and all of a sudden, the wind hit, the rain was flying sideways, freezing cold rain. You could tell that it was born of ice pellets, and just hit you in the face like a slap of a horse's tail when it was wet. Mm. I lived in London for many years, and the exciting thing about rain is it tastes and smells and feels differently everywhere. And
That's very true.
They have what we call steaming rain in London. And if you happen to be wearing eyeglasses and you take them off for one moment, they get this mist of rain on them. It's like seeing everything through a cloud, and it's surreal. You look and you see the lights moving with it. Traffic going, and you see people, and you can't quite make out who they are or what they are because you're in this cloud of rain. And I was competing in marksmanship one time at Camp Bisley outside of London. I was there in the United States Marine Corps, and I just kept shooting and shooting slowly and doing what I was trained to do. And in the Marine Corps, we have Maggie's drawers. When someone misses the target altogether, they wave this big pair of Maggie's drawers in the air. And the guys on both sides of me were getting Maggie's drawers, and I kept thinking, is that me? Am I missing? And I couldn't really see what I was doing.
Seeing through clouds. And Michael, you've taken us right to the end with your tale, but I'm so happy to have it. Rain born of ice pellets and the swat of a horse's tail. Every kind of evocation. Cynthia Barnett, you've brought it all on with your new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. Thank you so much for joining us today, Cynthia. It's been wonderful to
have
you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
A little more Raindrop Prelude, Chopin, thanks to him. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook with a little rain. This is On Point.